I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a theme that deserves a great deal of attention and receives virtually nothing in the mainstream or even the alternative media. And that is there a scientific basis for giving vaccination, including mandatory vaccination, to the tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people who receive it each year in the United States and around the world? On the one hand, we have virtually all of American science and medicine, that's 900,000 physicians, a large core of them being pediatricians, the entire structure, the CDC, the FDA, the National Institutes of Health, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which oversees vaccinations, all agreeing, and their agreements are put into articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, that indeed vaccinations have created an immune protection for the vast majority of people and been the number one reason that major illnesses over the centuries have been eradicated. Measles, scarlet fever, typhoid, whooping cough, diphtheria, and smallpox, and polio, to name several of the more important ones, that without these vaccinations, tens of millions more people would have died. So strong is this belief that it is virtually mandatory for many college students and people working within hospitals or healthcare settings to have multiple vaccinations. It was only when I was asked a question once by a nurse in New York State, why do I have to get four different vaccines before I work in a hospital? I began to look into this so I could give this person an intelligent answer. And by looking at the actual scientific literature, I could not come up with a convincing argument, and therefore felt that I would require more time. That time went on to be almost 5 years of in-depth research, reviewing more than 10,000 studies on the topic of vaccination, immunization, toxicology, and I finally come to a decision that we had been given partial truths, half-truths, and out-and-out lies, that behind the scenes, manipulating public health policy were the pharmaceutical interest and the major investors in those relatively small number of probably about 30 companies. And then I began to find that there was an enormous amount of lobbying. At that time, I did not know about ALEC, the group that represents the vaccine manufacturers as well as other major corporate interests who lobby at the state level, who actually write the laws that become the laws, and then we're expected to accept these laws without challenge. They virtually dominate all public health discussion. In fact, it is nearly impossible to contact any official media, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, and suggest that you have a legitimate challenge to any part of the vaccine dynamic. In the last 2 years, my office and our scholars in residence, including Dr. Richard Gale, myself, have researched and published 21 articles. All of these are fully referenced. We have done a massive amount of research and scholarship. We have not been found in error on a single point made. I have taken this case under oath to the New York Health Assembly Committee on Vaccinations. I have presented them with challenges that they have not responded to. You can watch that, and it's a little different than what you might expect when someone testifies before a committee, and the committee peppers them with questions, generally puts them on the defensive. It was just the opposite. I hit them with so many facts and so many statistics and so many insights, they were simply overwhelmed. Watch it for yourself and make your own decision. We have demonstrated in New Jersey when one of our guests, Louise Habakus, and others said we need a public dialogue on this. Should we have mandatory vaccines? We did it in Albany. where we stop mandatory vaccines of the H1N1 two shots and the flu vaccine two shots to the 56,000 public health workers in New York State, doctors, nurses, orderlies, etc., in hospitals. What has been missing in our debates and discussions and demonstrations are medical doctors. We've had nurses, but few doctors. So what we are doing now in this program, in this hour, we are going to deconstruct the argument from three different perspectives. First, the underlying foundation upon which all vaccines rest. Do vaccines, as they're given, individually and cumulatively, do they represent the best form of natural immunization to the body to protect us? If so, what is the evidence? If not, what is the evidence? Leading us in this discussion is a leading immunologist, someone who has a strong academic background. She is Dr. Tatiana Obenkanji. I'm not sure if that is proper pronunciation. She is an immunologist. She lives in San Francisco. Now, she has arrived at her conclusions through methodical research, and she believes that she will discuss with us the vaccine science and its premises and promises are remarkably unfounded. She is also the author of a recent book, Vaccine Illusion, How Vaccination Compromises Our Natural Immunity and What You Can Do to Regain Your Health. Tatiana was born in Ukraine. She came to USA and received her degrees in biochemistry and PhD in immunology from Rockefeller University, and subsequently did her postdoctoral research at Immune Disease Institute, affiliated with Harvard Medical School, and recently was a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford School of Medicine. She's currently a new mom and offers classes to parents about vaccination and immunity. She will be starting our conversation. She will be followed by Roman Bastrinic. Roman is an independent investigator and author, and he focuses on topics such as the science behind vaccine, but Roman has done something rather remarkable. He has taken the time and the scholarship to actually obtain the public health records on vaccination and the amount of death from vaccines, from different diseases, prior to vaccination. So for example, how many people were dying of diphtheria in 1900? And then how many people died in 1920 when the first vaccine was introduced? And then the penicillin mass production in 1944, and whooping cough vaccine in 1940, and the measles vaccine in 1964. And it is amazing what he has found. He's done the same with smallpox, looking at the Leicester smallpox mortality rates versus vaccine coverage. These are official public records. He has also done the England-Wales measles death rate from 1838 clear through 1978. So what we have here is we have hard science, real science, of how many people were dying prior to vaccination, the introduction of the vaccine, and we should have seen that about 95% of the people dying from the diseases stopped when the vaccine was introduced. There is no such proof. In fact, in every single situation, the charts clearly show, there is no ambiguity, that 95 to 98% of the disease was gone, completely gone, prior to any vaccine being introduced. Hence the question, why then should we be giving 100% of the credit, 100% of the credit to the vaccine when it was already gone? And assuming that we're able to reach Louise Habakus, she'll be talking about cracks in the pro-vaccine community and vaccine injury courts as evidence that vaccines do cause injury. Let us begin. First, over to my first guest. And we have time on our program, so we are not rushed. We only do one theme on this program. And let's introduce Dr. Tatiana. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, Gary. Nice to be with you.
Now, I just want to make sure that you spell your name O-B-H-U-K-H-A-N-Y-C-H. Is that Obenkanji?
Perfect. Yeah, this time you got it right.
Okay, good. Now, I'm going to give you a larger picture. Take your time because we're really looking for a classroom on the air.
Okay.
All right, here are the issues that we need to know from you. First, these are the big topics. The difference between natural immunity as a common course of life versus scientific or vaccine immunity that is induced by the introduction of one or more vaccines directly into the bloodstream, bypassing all of our natural defense barriers. Then, explain what is immunologic memory and why you believe or do not believe that it poses a health risk greater than the benefit. And then for our third, but not our final question, the role of the mucosal lining in natural immunity, which is bypassed every time you get a shot. It goes directly in the bloodstream. And I'm going to give it to you in this context. We're not limiting this to children, but let's just start when we look at a little baby. Now, as you know, as an immunologist, a little baby has virtually no immune system except that which has been given to it through the mother and through her placental antibodies and immune modulators, and then later through breast milk. Explain what happens when you take a baby just born and you give them a hepatitis vaccine, or when you give them within the first year, you give them 6 more vaccines, and these are highly toxic chemicals. You have aluminum, you have formaldehyde, polysorbate, 80, you can have thimerosal, mercury. You can have different ingredients, none of which are healthy, all of which are shown to be antagonistic to normal immune processes. So if you can include all this, because these are all part of us better understanding our immune systems and the argument that we need to be vaccinated in order to create a herd immunity to protect us from people who are not vaccinated. The form is yours. Take your time and take a step by step through this.
Okay, so let's start from the very beginning. Natural immunity versus vaccine immunity. Well, the thing is that the basic conclusion that I reached is that whatever mechanisms that the vaccine induce in the immune system, they do not lead to permanent immunity the way natural exposure does. And this is not something that is generally believed by the science of immunology or by immunologists. I've been among immunologists for a very long time, and I know what kind of discussions are going on there. What immunologists believe is based on the theory that they have developed over the last probably 100 years or more. And that theory is the theory of so-called immunologic memory, and I will explain what it is and how it works. So this theory, it justifies vaccination. It gives credence or credibility to vaccination as a method of disease prevention. But what immunologists don't understand when they're sitting in their, ivory towers, and they don't really look at how vaccination plays out in real life and what protection does it give, what they don't see is that there is way too much of vaccine failure around. And this is what public health officials notice, because when they analyze any disease outbreak out there and they see who got involved in the outbreak, the breakdown is usually that the majority of people who are involved in the outbreak are vaccinated rather than unvaccinated. And perhaps, it's not that surprising knowing that vaccination coverage is pretty high in our country. And perhaps disease just targets vaccinated and unvaccinated indiscriminately, couldn't care less about vaccination status. So, what do public health officials do? Instead of going back to immunologists and tell them, you gave us vaccine and it's a lemon and doesn't really work as you advertised or as you the way we expect it to work to provide the permanent immunity for life, it only provides maybe short-term protection. That's what they can statistically determine from analysis of the ages involved in the outbreak. But instead of, questioning the principle of vaccination and the theory behind it, and maybe if we understood, immunity better, we would find a different way of, gaining immunity. Instead, they just go for a practical decision for a practical way of solving the problem of short-term protection and introduce just more and more boosters for pretty much every vaccine that there is out there. But I would suggest that we have to start talking to each other, public health officials have to start talking to immunologists, and immunologists have to be a little bit more accountable for their theories. And we have to really look deep into the principle of vaccination and the principle of immunologic memory and what it is really. So this is what I will describe next, immunologic memory, what it is. Immunologic memory, it's sort of a classical concept in immunology, and what it is, it's defined as faster, better, you know, a bigger immune response to the antigen, to re-exposure to the same antigen. So the first time you see an antigen could be anything, any foreign protein or foreign virus. I mean, virus would be considered foreign to our body. The first time immunologists say the immune response, and what is the immune response? Basically, antibody production. That's the easiest thing to concentrate on. It's very kind of delayed, slow, so it's not there. But the second time we see the same pathogen or the same antigen, the same protein, this response is much, much faster. And this is how immunologists explain immunity. So if the second time around you see a pathogen and the immune response is much, much faster, then they say, well, this is what protects you from the disease. And immunologic memory is basically, well, the immune system seen this pathogen once, and now for the rest of the life it remembers the pathogen and can, respond to it faster. Well, if that was the case, then we shouldn't be seeing vaccine failures, because once we provide vaccine, what is a vaccine? Vaccine, it's the same kind of virus which has been attenuated by certain means, or it's a dead virus that has been inactivated by formaldehyde or by other methods, or it's just a caught protein from the virus, just like a scaffold without the viral DNA in it, something that resembles the virus. And, if the theory was correct that all you need to see is this kind of ghost of the virus the first time and remember that, and that would give you protection for life, then we would be good with vaccines. But this is not how it works, and we see pretty much epidemiological evidence telling us otherwise. So then, is the concept of immunologic memory completely false or inapplicable to anything? Actually, no. The concept of immunologic memory is very much, reproducible, and you can do experiments and justify and see it every time it's there. But what I realized is that immunologic memory, instead of explaining immunity, it actually explains very well a totally different process that we encounter in our lives quite often these days, and that's the process of allergy development. So, first of all, the way immunologists arrived at this concept of immunologic memory is not by doing experiments with viruses or with pathogens. Well, because it's kind of dangerous to work with those entities in the lab, but they were just simplifying things, and they were working with just proteins, something which is not infectious, but still foreign to the body, so we can sort of see how immune system reacts to that. So the whole concept of immunologic memory was developed based on the work with proteins. And what kind of proteins that can be problematic in our life? Oh, those are called allergens. So some proteins from food, like some proteins from peanuts or from, from pollen, those are the things that cause allergy, and they actually also stimulate immunologic memory. So in a way, immunologic memory describes very well how the first step in allergy development happens, and that is sensitization. And after that, every time you get exposed to the same allergen, you get better, faster, and, you know, quicker immune response, as well as allergy symptoms, and that kind of immunologic memory you get for life. However, whether that's a good thing to have or it's better to forget that kind of, exposure, it's pretty much, I think, it's the other way around. We should, instead of thinking how to stimulate immunologic memory development, we have to be looking at the ways how to terminate it. And I think that would be a really big help in understanding how to cope with allergy.
Tatiana, I appreciate that insight. Could you now give us an example, and let me share this with you. When I was in Germany studying the work of Dr. Joseph Issels, the great cancer expert who was able to cure more terminal cancer patients than any other scientist or physician in world history that we're aware of, 16.6% of terminal cases were alive and well and without cancer 5 years later. And he uses a combination of therapies. But one of the things he did was natural immune stimulation. And I watched him as he put people through very stress-inducing exercises. And I asked, why are you doing that? Shouldn't you try to be relaxing people? And he said, you first have to stress the body in a healthy way in order to develop natural immunity, and then you're able to de-stress them so that the natural immunity strengthens them. And he says, for example, when you were growing up, Gary, did your mother, since you're a baby boomer, did your mother ever expose you to cold winter? I said, yes. Every day, it was her policy that all of her sons, she would put it, or wrap up, you know, and give us warm clothing, but she'd put us outside. She expected us to be outside playing in the cold. She wanted us to get strong, and she'd give us caliber oil. And then when we were on the farm, we were expected. I was expected to go in and, as a kid, and milk the cows at 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, you know how dirty a barn is. You can't. There's no such thing as a clean barn. And we picked up all kinds of microorganisms. But Dr. Issel said, when you're picking up natural microorganisms and at the same time you're compensating by helping your body stay strong, you actually develop a natural immunity. And now a late study just last week showed that those children who are raised in the country around animals, in barns, in fields, exposed to all forms of animal danders and pollens, actually have a stronger immune system, become less susceptible to disease because of that natural immunity. Now, is that what Dr. Issel saw? In fact, he even did something interesting. When he was doing his, making his own concoctions, he would roll the eggs in the laboratory every 2 hours. And I said, why are you rolling the eggs? He said, it stresses the embryo. So for the embryo to survive, it has to adapt to the stress. So hence, the more stress you have, the better able you are to cope with it and adapt, the stronger you become. And I wondered, is that just a theory on his own? But he ended up with the best cancer cures in the world. So taking that, is any of that making sense to you when you're talking about developing natural immunity?
So one thing to realize is that immunology, the science that we define as immunology, doesn't study anything at all about natural immunity. It studies pretty much the process, which is quite artificial, and it is limited to that, to studying that process. And so basically, the artificial process is really delivering all the antigens and pathogens by injection, as you mentioned before, rather than by natural exposure. So what we know about natural exposure is very limited, or perhaps we sort of derive our theories from artificial experiments and stretch them to understand natural exposure. And of course, that doesn't really work that well to explain that. So I would think that you start with empirical observation, just like the doctor that you mentioned. And if you see that these methods work empirically, then you have to start studying them and understand what is the theory behind it. But that's not the province of immunology as we define it now. Probably we need a new science of immunology, the one that studies natural immunity and natural exposure to disease, and this is something that we're really in need of.
There was a physician that I interviewed many years ago. His name was Dr. Hans Selye. He was the what is considered the pioneer of distress medicine, differentiating between healthy stress and toxic stress or distress. And at that time, I was working as a scientist, a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, which is a very orthodox cancer research center. And I was doing the strange work in anti-aging medicine on my own upstairs. And there was a person who's a research fellow there named Dr. Lawrence LeShan, a great psychologist. And LeShan and I would have some conversations. And he was working on a theory that he was able to prove, and a doctor, a former New York State health commissioner, followed in his footsteps. And I also work talk with him at length about this. And he said, I can predict from a conversation with a woman her susceptibility to breast cancer. I said, how so? He says, women who feel victimized or unappreciated or undervalued are more likely to develop breast cancer. And those, and then he went through those who are most susceptible to developing arthritis. And each one of these, he said, there's a profile. And then he did a study and found that in a group of 500 completely healthy women with no history of cancer in the family, he determined from in-depth interviews their susceptibility. They never knew this. And then over a period of 20 years, a very high percentage of those that he pointed out would end up with breast cancer did so. This was a radical concept. And later, this doctor, I believe his name was Kaiser. I was sitting with him one night at the Institute, and he says, man, I'm sitting on some dynamite material. I said, what's that? He said, well, we can pretty accurately guess who's going to get sick, seriously sick with cancer, based upon how they deal with stress. And I said, and by what mechanisms? Now, at that point, there was really no field of psychoneuroimmunology. Now there's over 2,000 studies in it. And medicine just did not accept this dynamic of body-mind. It was more of a Descartes, that the brain is above and the body is below, and they're separated. In any case, he said, and I remember him saying this to me, he said, how do you feel when you're around a depressed person? I said, de-energized. How about an angry person? De-energized. How about an arrogant person? De-energized. How about a controlling person? De-energized. He said, and what do you think is going on in your biochemistry when you're de-energized? And I said, well, your immune system is probably spiking, and then it cannot hold that spike because it's a flight or fright response, and then it's becoming depressed, and hence then you're susceptible to all forms of infections. Hence, i.e., when you have an argument, the next day is more you're more likely to have a sore throat, a cold, a flu. Now, did that just happen overnight? No, but your immune system, which was protecting you from what's already in your body, was so challenged. So then I tried something. I took 100 marathon runners, all of whom were vegan, never did drugs, never smoked like myself. I've never smoked a cigarette, never drank, never done any drugs at all. And a whole group of us, 100, took our biochemistries in depth. And then we trained for 6 months to do the New York City Marathon. Now, the week before the New York City Marathon, we did it, the blood chemistry. The week after we did it, and we found overall that our immune system the week before the New York City Marathon was as low in our T cells as a person with AIDS. But here's the difference. We divided the group into two. One group would go through a series of de-stressing exercises, including flotational tanks, taking supplements, and our biochemistry was as good as ever. The other group's biochemistry was extremely challenged, and indeed they came down with more colds and flus and injuries than the group that had not compensated. So I came up with a theory that immunity is greatly enhanced by compensation, meaning whatever you're going to be doing, compensate by its opposite. And hence, you're able then to build natural immunity. Now, does any of this that I've just shared with you, does this tie in with what you're talking about, or is this a separate issue altogether?
I think it's probably a separate issue. However, I'm really you know, myself very interested in the science of psychoneuroimmunology and also the mind-body connection, I think we are sort of restricting the immune system to how immunologists define the immune system, and I think this is too limited. I don't think the immune system is just the compilation of these particular T cells, B cells, and whatever, but it's also our nutritional status, because it is known in the literature that certain vitamins are very important in our resistance to viral infections. And at least two that I can name is vitamin A and vitamin C. And they have different mechanisms of how they do it. However, you know, immunologists don't want to, you know, study nutrition or to do any experiments that has anything to do with vitamins. So they just happily study their B cells and T cells, and that's all they, you know. But it's a very limited view of the immune system to define it that way.
All right. A few more issues then, please. Explain the role of adjuvants, in particular aluminum, which is used in most vaccines, because we know aluminum is a neurotoxic element. It will destroy neurons, and yet it's in the vaccines. And when they started taking mercury, thimerosal, out of vaccines, they increased the amount of aluminum. So what is the role of aluminum and adjuvants in creating what I might call false immunity, or contributing to the sensitization and adverse effects such as allergies and autoimmune disorders in those who've been vaccinated?
Okay, so the primary purpose of vaccines, as sort of the according to immunologic dogmas, is that vaccines are supposed to produce antibodies against viruses or bacteria or whatever that we want them to produce antibodies against. So when a foreign entity enters the body, you know, the immune system has to sort of distinguish whether it's foreign or whether it's self, right? Or whether it's innocuous or whether it's dangerous. And viruses, viral structures in themselves, they already have certain patterns that alert the immune system that this is something dangerous. So the immune system would start making antibodies against those viruses. However, a bunch of vaccines, they don't have just whole viral, body in there. They just have a protein from the virus or from the bacterium. And the protein by itself is not going to induce antibody production just because it looks quite innocuous to the immune system. I guess that's how we sort of think about it. So in order to trick the immune system into antibody production, there has to be some kind of help. So they put adjuvants. Adjuvants are helpers, so it comes from a Latin word, and so they help to trick the immune system into antibody production. Now, so alum is one of those adjuvants. Others would be some mineral oil or something of that sort. But the way adjuvant sort of tricks the immune system into signaling the danger is that, first of all, it's a cytotoxic substance, and it kills cells. It kills cells, I guess, at the site of injection. And what happens is that when cells die, they sort of spill out their internal constituents, including DNA and uric acid and whatnot. And that damage sort of is sensed by immune system, that there is some damage going on, and that whatever protein that comes into the, at the site of injection, in the midst of that damage, is considered dangerous. So then immune system sort of starts antibody production against that protein. So if you didn't have the damage, you wouldn't have antibody production. So that's the whole point of having alum in vaccines. Well, as you mentioned, alum is also a neurotoxin, but immunologists don't care about that, right? So there were there were some studies showing that when mice are immunized with alum, in proportion to how much humans would be immunized in proportion to body weight, they see some behavioral abnormalities in those mice, and they do detect alum in their brains, even though the alum injection was in the skin. So we basically have what alum does for the immune system is antibody production, and what else it does for the body, it's not so good either. So that's about alum.
Okay, I just have two more questions for you. Numerous children today have been harmed by vaccines. That is not a matter of issue. They have been rewarded some damages by the government's own very challenging agency that was stacked by pro-vaccine industry scientists, making it all the more difficult to get compensation. One area of the government has given over 61 families multi-million dollar awards, acknowledging that neurological damage, including autism, was due to the vaccines. Another agency of government, the FDA, by the way, this is the same FDA that was caught over the weekend illegally collecting over 80,000 private emails, including conversations between journalists and activists and whistleblowers and their attorneys and even the Inspector General of the FDA. Now, that's against the law. That is a felony. That means all the people engaged, and there's a lot of them engaged, should be arrested. And it also shows how corrupt this agency is. I want people to remember that. I'm going to be doing an in-depth discussion on this tomorrow at 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the show following mine on the Whistleblowers Hour. In any case, this same compromised FDA has stacked every vaccine schedule advisory panel with at least 55 to 60% of the people on the panel voting for a vaccine coming from the vaccine industry or having a gross conflict of interest. Royalties, commissions, stipends, research grants coming from the vaccine industry. Therefore, sitting when you're making money off vaccines and saying yes to a vaccine is a gross conflict of interest. Yet that's the same vaccine, and it also works the same way at the CDC. So there's no legitimate science at all that is not corrupted at the FDA and CDC. In spite of this, the American public have been led to believe by the local doctors who appear as experts, which they are not, on programs, that there's no harm to vaccines, that vaccines are essential. So, here is the issue. Having absolute proof of vaccines' dangers to those children who died, like Gardasil, 111 deaths, 25,000 adverse reports given to the FDA, knowing that only about 5 to 7% of all adverse reports are ever given, then the actual number could be about, let's say, at least 10 times that amount. And yet, the drug industry's legal arguments remain that there can be no certain proof that a vaccine causes any adverse effects. How would you counter that argument based upon the immunological and vaccine science that you are now studying and are familiar with?
So, immunology is not really authorized to say much about vaccine injuries. Well, pretty much, again, because it's a very limited science and we only look at immune responses and nothing beyond that. We're just not equipped to study adverse effects on the body. So we are not even expert to say something against or for that. And I guess if people say that vaccines, cannot cause injury based on immunologic knowledge, that's wrong. We are not qualified to say it one way or the other. So, let's say regardless of how individuals view vaccine injuries, whether they view it to be something really outstanding or something very infrequent, we have to understand what it is that we gain, what kind of benefits that we gain from vaccination to kind of counterbalance those injuries to individuals and to the society. And what we gain, as I described before, we gain very short-term benefits, which is very short-term protection from disease, which keeps expiring constantly. Well, we don't revaccinate all the way into adulthood, we kind of leave the whole population, the whole adult population, non-immune to the diseases. So if there is an outbreak, and any adult can pretty much get involved in that, we also destroy herd immunity, right? So the whole idea that vaccination keeps building up herd immunity is actually wrong. It's the other way around. Then the most problematic thing is that because the immunity doesn't last into adulthood, there is no way that mothers can protect their infants by means of the immunity transfer the way it was before. So now infants are also vulnerable to the disease if there is exposure. So vaccination in itself, even if we don't speak about those gross adverse reactions, the vaccination in itself really creates a problem for the society in the long run, and we are in that problem right now for measles, mumps, rubella, right, for those diseases for which vaccines have been used for a long time, and we are creating the same problem with chickenpox now, because right now, well, chickenpox is considered a mild childhood disease, yet we decided to go ahead with vaccines and to start eradicating this chickenpox virus, and we are heading in the same direction. We are going to make this mild disease severe because we are going to push the disease into adulthood and into infancy and leaving infants without maternal protection. And that will happen in a few decades, not yet, because right now mothers still have, they all had pretty much disease experience with chickenpox in their own childhood. They can still protect their infants. But this is going to change in a few decades. And then, you know, chickenpox is going to be as dangerous as what we think of measles or smallpox or whatever. So it's really not in our favor the way we use vaccination.
Okay, I just have one final question, starting with a statement. It is my belief that the so-called science of immunology and vaccination is not foolproof. Why? I have repeatedly found studies that high degrees of the disease came into the crowd who had full vaccination from that. So it was measles, they had all their shots. Mumps, all their shots. And yet they came down with the worst case, not just measles, but the worst case of it. And in some cases, almost everyone who came down with the measles had been fully vaccinated with the measles. So if the idea that they've been postulating that if you get immunized, then you're protected by the vaccine, then there's gross failures in that. And therefore, they can say, well, it's idiopathic, and I'm saying it's idiotic. If you can't show us, if you cannot show us a higher degree of certainty, then you shouldn't be experimenting on us and expecting us to accept it. And lastly, and I really need you to address this, I have seen no proof whatsoever that anyone has ever followed any large cohort group for a long period of time and then decided those that received the vaccines did not come down with the disease and can prove to me that it was the vaccination and not other lifestyle factors that prevented them from coming down with the disease, because we know that other things such as a person's immune state, a person's supplementation, giving high doses of the omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin C and bioflavonoids, etc., etc., can make a difference in helping natural immunity. And therefore, the studies are in the hundreds that the stronger your immune system by your own choices of what you drink and eat, plus the science of psychoneuroimmunology, the stronger you are in your immune responses in a healthy way, the less susceptible you are to any of the regular diseases, tells me that they are taking credit for people staying healthy who are exercising, who are eating right, who are de-stressing, who are taking their supplements, and yet we're giving 100% credit that they didn't come down with a measles or chickenpox or smallpox or polio to the vaccines, and there is no science whatsoever that I have found, unless you're going to tell me one now, that can prove that immunology can then give the stamp and moniker of authenticity to long-term protection through vaccination, simply by measuring antibodies, which in and of themselves cannot always indicate that a person is going to be protected, because we've seen that people who have had low antibodies not get a disease and high antibodies to an antigen get the disease. So show me where I am wrong in my statements.
I don't think you're wrong. I'm very much in agreement, especially with your first statement that the science of immunology shouldn't take credit for explaining immunity. We just cannot explain immunity with our theories that we have at hand. I totally agree that proper nutrition and resistance to stress of all kinds is what makes the disease goes either very mild or sometimes even asymptomatic, so that you wouldn't even know you had the exposure. Now with them, finally, you know, another factor that we have to kind of take into account is also the degree of exposure that we have. And overall, because I believe that vaccines do give short-term protection, overall, I think they do limit the habitat of the viruses in our population, because certain viruses can exist only in human bodies. Humans are the only sort of reservoirs for those viruses. So the elimination of the exposure, which may not be such a good thing actually, I think vaccines have something to do with it. However, it's a very long process. It doesn't happen within a few years. It takes usually 50 to 40 years to eliminate the exposure of the virus, just like, measles virus was eliminated endemically in the United States. Well, whether it's only vaccines, probably not. Quarantine is another factor that can sort of eliminate the exposure, and we don't know. Maybe it's all done by quarantine rather than vaccines. But elimination of the exposure over such a long stretch of time is another factor that sort of endangers us, especially the last generation who are still exposed to the virus but without having immunity, which has been destroyed by vaccination. So those are the things that I can say.
Well, I appreciate you having the courage and the integrity to take your research to the public, because you are one of the very few immunologists with an outstanding academic background from Rockefeller University, from Harvard Medical School, and from Stanford School of Medicine to have published and come forward and tell us the truth. And we appreciate that you are no longer part of the immunized herd of academia. I thank you very much, Dr. Tatiana.
Thank you, Gary.
Dr. Tatiana Obakanich, my guest, author of Vaccine Illusion. I'm Gary Knoll. Let us go now to our final panelists. We were not able to reach one of our guests, but we do have Roman Pastrnak on the line now, and I gave you his background a little earlier. Nice to have you with us today, Roman.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Now, Roman, here's what I'd like for you to do.
Mm-hmm.
We, and it's a very simplistic argument, we have been told that vaccinations are what have eradicated the major illnesses, from smallpox to polio, from measles to diphtheria, and from whooping cough to typhoid. I want you to go through the actual public health graphs, which are posted. Someone can look at them right now by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. We have them posted. These are actual graphs, and show us from the measurement of a disease and the death, mortality, until the introduction of the vaccine, what you found, and therefore, would you state at this point that we should be giving 100% of the credit or any of the credit to a vaccine for the eradication when the vaccines were introduced virtually at the end stage of a disease process?
Okay, well, the graphs are up online, I take it, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you can look at those graphs, whoever can get access to them, but you really don't need the graphs. They're very helpful, but I can basically talk to them. Each of the graphs is based on really a lot of data gathered over the years. Each graph has embedded into it references, so anybody can go and verify what the graphs, how the graphs were constructed. I began looking at the vaccines when our children were born about 15 years ago. Really right away, I had an uneasy feeling about vaccinating my children. Something didn't sit right with me, but, you know, there's a lot of pressure just to vaccinate people. It bothered me that I really didn't know that much about the shots, so I started doing my own research, and I started getting into medical journals, and, you know, I found things like low efficacy rates and ingredients and that type of thing. At one point, though, I found a book by Neil Miller. And what caught my eye in that book was that it showed the death rate for measles falling by 95% before the introduction of the measles vaccine. And I thought, well, you know, that can't be right. I thought, like I think most people do, is the vaccines wiped out these diseases. So this graph seemed way out of line to me. But I have an engineering background, and I'm very analytical. So I decided to verify some of the data and see if the graph was real or not. I took a trip to a local library and found some almanac or some book, and I got some basic points, and I put them right on graph paper. And right away, it was clear that with those 10 points or so, that really matched the book graph. And that really bothered me, because vaccines were here to eliminate these diseases, and these graphs were saying something the opposite. But to me, this data wasn't really accurate enough, so I went to the Yale Medical Library and other libraries and got a bunch of old statistics books like the U.S. Vital Statistics to start. I carefully went through these old books and photocopied all the pages and entered all the data into a spreadsheet program, and the different disease rates and disease deaths. Once I had all that entered, I wanted to see what the measles looked like, so I graphed that. What that detailed data showed was that measles death had declined around 98% before the vaccine, which was really quite shocking to me. This was nothing I was ever told by anybody. It just didn't fit the vaccine paradigm. Another thing that shocked me was that for whooping cough, something similar had been down by over 90% before the vaccine was available. And if you can find the graph online, you can see the first graph shows that. And that graph shows that not only whooping cough and measles, but scarlet fever, typhoid, and diphtheria were all declining through the 1900s. After I got that data, I was able to get data from other places. Some of the most important data was from England in a town called Leicester. The data from England and Leicester was important because they began keeping the statistics back in 1838, which is 62 years before the official officially being kept in the United States, which started in 1900. So I took the data and carefully entered the data in, and you can see one of the graphs up there about measles. And that showed the decline in deaths from measles starting in 1838 and ending in 1970, as you had said. It showed that from the mid to late 1800s, the deaths from measles declined dramatically. The measles vaccine began to be used in England in 1968. Now, this is very important. By the time the vaccine in 1968, the death rate from measles, which was a big killer back in the 1800s, had declined by over 99.9% from the peak death rate. So measles deaths had really fallen by almost 100% before the vaccine was in use.
Okay, you've made your points. The charts are there. These are not your charts. These are public health statistics and charts.
Right.
So now we have independent confirmation that the vaccines have been given the credit when indeed as much as 99.99% of the disease was gone prior to the vaccine. In one case, measles, for example. Now, here's my final question. What has your research shown was the actual cause of the reduction in deaths from these diseases?
Well, yeah, I'd just like to add that the whooping cough was something similar. That had dropped by 99% as well. Now, the measles is a virus caused by a virus, and whooping cough is bacterial, but they both were basically eliminated by the time the vaccines came along. Also, scarlet fever disappeared without any vaccine. If you look at the graphs for scarlet fever, it was a much bigger killer than measles, whooping cough, even smallpox. Now, what happened during the in the 1800s, the environment was not this idyllic, wonderful thing you might see in the movies. There was a lot of dire poverty. People were overworked. They were malnourished. There was no sanitation. It was a dreadful time to be alive, actually, for a lot of people, unless you were quite wealthy. And what happened over the mid to late 1800s is sanitation started being put in place. People started having labor laws put in place. Children didn't have to work in mines anymore. So all these different things came to play at the same time, and so that there was a lot less stress on individuals. So as you went from the late 1800s to the 1900s, these just death rates just plummeted as people became essentially healthier. The environment improved. Sanitation was put in place. People were no longer living in such filthy conditions. And I think that was really the key, and other factors, but those were the key things that really got rid of all these diseases. And it's important to remember that all these infectious diseases, smallpox, diphtheria, whooping cough, et cetera, these all declined essentially at the same time.
So let me just summarize here and see if this is correct. because I went to England to study this as well on several occasions. When they stopped throwing people who died into the river, when they began to introduce water and septic systems into the cities, before you would just defecate in a bucket and it'd be thrown out the window each day, and you'd have sweeps that would come along and sweep this mess. You had no refrigeration. As a result, breads and other grains would ferment, and there'd be open to vermin, and rats were everywhere. And people didn't wash their hands, they didn't wash their bodies, and they had no access to fresh fruits and vegetables on most occasions. And much of the fish was already, unless you got it in the morning it was caught, the fish would have been contaminated. Any meats that you had, a chance to eat, though most people didn't eat meats, would have been contaminated because there was no refrigeration. And grains were left outside and fermented, so there were aflatoxins. So when you introduced roads and got more produce coming in of the city, when you had cleaner sanitation, when you eliminated child labor laws, when you began the unionization process to get better health care, when you had hygiene introduced, when you started pasteurization of milk and eliminating tuberculosis and other milk-borne bacteria, when you started cleaning up the water supply and having healthier water, these were the principal reasons that all of these diseases began to decline at the same time and continued until it was almost completely eradicated. Is that a yes or no?
That's a yes. They had awful nutrition back in the 1800s, a lot of people. They would have virtually no vegetables, no fruits. They would have diseased meat markets where they would just hang the meat up there and you would, pick up something that was really just putrid. And people would be eating this all the time. And as far as, things just basically running off into the river, people would be drinking from these polluted sources. So they're continuously subjected to this horrible environment. And overstressed with the work, sometimes working 14, 16 hours a day. And so, anybody subjected to these kind of things would be immunocompromised and subject to all sorts of diseases.
You also had tremendous air pollution because you had no standards for burning coal. And in central London, everyone burned coal, and the coal was kept in the basement, and the entire house would have been filled with coal fumes, which we know now cause different diseases of the lung and the respiratory system. And so when this all started to get cleaned up, things changed. And isn't it amazing, Roman, that no credit was given to the public health measures? It was all given to the vaccine. That was one of the most perfect public relations indoctrination campaigns in history.
Yeah, it is quite amazing. And, there was no pollution laws. You had all sorts of factories right there in the cities. You had slaughterhouses. Everything was just intermixed. And all the smoke that was generated, that was the famous London fog as part of that. So you had all this awful environment, and stench must have been just tremendous. And you're right, the credit was given to the vaccines, and in the case of smallpox, even where you had strict laws put in place, like places in Massachusetts in 1855, there was really no effect with these strict compulsory laws. In the case of Massachusetts, for example, in 1855, the 20 years before the strict laws, and the 20 years after, there was more people dying after the strict laws than there were before.
Meaning and people so forced to get vaccinated.
Yeah, everybody was being vaccinated. I can actually read the actual laws put in place. But, so everybody was being vaccinated, and despite these high vaccination rates, there continued to be epidemics, including the 1872 pandemic that went around the world and caused tremendous death, even though tremendously high vaccination rates. But after 1872, people basically got fed up with all this stuff. They didn't see any real good positive results, and they started protesting against it. They fought against it. Vaccination rates dropped, and the smallpox deaths then began to decline, along with all the other diseases, because you had all this stuff going on at the same time with the sanitation and hygiene coming into play.
Roman Bistrinic, and the website is healthsentinel.com. Roman has the charts there. We have the charts. I thank Roman for doing the scholarship and research to get us these charts that tell the truth. So the next time you hear one of these people saying, but without vaccines, we would have had more people die of measles, polio, and smallpox, you'll say, No, you're just the opposite. It was never shown that they reduced any of these. They were all gone prior to the vaccine, and that's just the way the money plays. Thank you very much, Roman Bistrenik.
Thanks very much.
I'm Gary Knoll. That ends this hour of our program, a special on the Progressive Commentary Hour on the subject of vaccination and immunization, and also public health measures that really caused a reduction in the instance of death and disease, which should get the credit instead of vaccines that did get the credit. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother,
what's
this is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, stop.